You go back and look at the law of Moses and ask, how was it that the priests and Levites were supported? There was a fairly extensive answer to that. The Lord had a number of ways of providing for the financial needs of the priests and the Levites, the entire tribe of Levi. It started partly with them taking the tithes. The tithes were essentially given to the Levites, who in turn took a tithe and gave it to the priests. The priests were responsible for offering the sacrifices, but many of the sacrifices that were offered parts of them could be consumed, and so they got the food from that. And then on top of that, each of the 12 tribes was supposed to give a certain number of cities to both the priests and the Levites, places for them to live, and not just for them to live, but they also had a certain area on the outside of it where they could keep their herds and their flocks. So they had a nice little network of a nice little system, I guess, of financial support that God through Moses had allowed for the entire tribe, for them, so that they could do their work as priests and Levites. The problem is that it worked well. It worked really well as long as everybody did their part. But if a tribe did not allot the cities for the priests or Levites, that created a problem. Or if they did not offer the sacrifices that they were supposed to offer, then that could create a problem as well. But the whole system assumed that everybody was doing their part and that everything would work out accordingly. And that brings us to the book of Judges. In the opening chapter, two chapters of Judges, one of the saddest parts is that there's a constant emphasis on the fact that the Israelites did not win the land like they were supposed to. Under Joshua, they were supposed to go into the land and conquer the land and drive out the foreigners. Well, they failed to do that time and time again. If you turn to Judges chapter 1, notice this repeating refrain all through this first chapter. Chapter 1, verse 21 of Judges. But the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. You look at chapter 1, verse 27. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Iblim and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. Verse 29, and Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants. Verse 31, Asher did not drive out the inhabitants. Verse 33, Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants. So it at least raises the question, if the Levites and priests actually got all the cities that they were supposed to. Now, you go back to Joshua chapter 21, before Joshua died, at least in principle, the cities were allotted. I think at the very least, they designated the cities that were supposed to be there. But if they failed to drive out all the inhabitants of these particular areas, it at least raises the question, was that a permanent thing? Did the Levites actually get the land that they were supposed to? Or did that create some other problems? Also, the fact that the Israelites did not drive out the inhabitants had some repercussions in several ways. For one thing, the Lord rebuked them for it in chapter 2. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this that you have done? And if you'll notice in verse 4, as soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed to the Lord. Bochim meant weepers. They cried at Bochim. Now, that's a significant note. It starts out in Gilgal. You remember Gilgal? That was the first place that the Israelites stayed when they got into the Promised Land. That was where they were circumcised. They named it Gilgal because Gilgal signified the idea of rolling away the shame, rolling away the disgrace of the Israelites. When they were circumcised there, that was the first time in an entire generation they had been circumcised as the law required. So it was a starting point. It was a renewal point for the nation of Israel. And every major military campaign they had in the book of Joshua started out at Gilgal. So Gilgal symbolized everything that was right with the conquest of the land. Well, the Lord leaves Gilgal and meets them at this place called Bochim and says, you have failed to do what I told you to do. And this is either right at the end of the time of Joshua or right at the beginning of the time of the judges. So in such a short time, they have completely failed, and so they begin to weep. That little note from Gilgal to Bochim really kind of symbolizes the failure of the Israelites. So their failure to drive out the inhabitants of the land had a lot of repercussions. There's one other thing I want you to notice in chapter 1. Verse 34, the Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres, in Aijalon, and in Shaalbim, but the hand of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor. And the border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah, and upward. It talks about the Amorites pressing against the people of Dan. It caused the Danite tribe to have some problems. And that comes up again at the end of the book. In fact, this seems to be tied in sort of like bookends. You start with a problem with the Amorites and Dan, and you end with some of the problems that that creates. When you go to the end of the book of Judges, you wind up, there's a sort of an appendix to the book, or maybe an epilogue. It starts in chapter 17 and goes through chapter 21, describing two incidents that tell you how bad things were during the Judges period. And these are pretty bleak times. And one of the first story that we're told about in chapter 17 and 18 is a story about a very enterprising Levite and a very enterprising guy in Micah and a bunch of very enterprising people from the tribe of Dan. It seems like everything is for sale in Israel except the right stuff. Morality is for sale, the priesthood is for sale, land is for sale. Everyone is taking whatever they can get, and there's wheeling and dealing. So I want us to look at this interesting story in chapter 17 and 18 as the basis of our sermon tonight. I'm calling this the art of the deal. It's the relationship between a man named Micah, a Levite that he hires to be a priest, and the Danites who are looking for anything they can get. And again, there's a whole bunch of wheeling and dealing in these two chapters. And it makes the Israelites look awfully bad because underneath all of this is the idea that they have failed to carry out the law of God. And as a consequence, they resort to their own resourcefulness. Instead of relying on the Lord, they rely on their wheeling and dealing and what's the best deal that I can get out of this. And that seems to be the underlying theme in this story. As we mentioned, the book of Judges has three parts to it. There's the prologue in chapters 1 and 2, the first part of chapter 3. It basically explains what went bad. As we just read in chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, what went bad is they failed to carry out the commands of God, and this has repercussions through the rest of the book. The heart of the book, starting in chapter 3, verse 7, and going through the end of chapter 16, is the story of the judges, and you see a gradual decline in the spiritual vitality of the nation. You see a gradual decline in the quality of the leadership. You see a gradual decline in the attitude of the people. The main part of the book, the story of the judges, illustrates the gradual decline of the nation. And then as a backdrop, what you have is the epilogue, where you have these two stories that I just mentioned. And this just shows what's going on behind the scenes. You look at some of the judges and you shake your head and think, what on earth were they doing? But then when you look at the people behind them, it's also easy to understand as well, and that's what's illustrated in chapters 17 through 21. So the book starts with the question, what went wrong, and then the rest of the book simply illustrates thing after thing that went wrong. You look at chapter 17 through 21, the finale. There is a phrase that occurs four times in the book. Chapter 17, verse 6, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Part of that phrase occurs in chapter 18, verse 1. In those days, there was no king in Israel. You look in chapter 19, verse 1. The phrase occurs again. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And finally, in chapter 21, down in verse 25, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So it starts and ends, this epilogue starts and ends with that reminder that not only is it a reminder of the political conditions, it's a reminder of the moral conditions as well. Everyone was pretty much doing their own thing, which is not a good commentary on God's people. When God's people resort to making their own rules, it is always a catastrophe. And that should clue us in to the nature of this particular story. Now that one phrase, everyone did what was right in his own eyes, I want you to turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 12. There's an important connection here. I'll get back to it a little bit later, if I remember to. But in Deuteronomy chapter 12, in verse 8, this is Moses exhorting the Israelites about things they were supposed to do when they got into the land. Chapter 12 of Deuteronomy is about not building shrines. There was only one acceptable place of worship. That was where God appointed. God chose the place. And the place where they were supposed to do it was wherever he sent the tabernacle. They could only worship at the tabernacle. If they encountered shrines and high places, they were to tear them down. They were not to build their own. And I want you to notice how Moses addresses this in Deuteronomy 12, verse 8. You shall not do according to all that we are doing here today, everyone doing whatever is right in his own eyes. That was a problem even in Moses' day. And obviously Moses, through the Lord's guidance, understood that this would be a problem when the Israelites got into the promised land. Some of them would continue to do their own thing. Some of them would continue to do what they believed was right, whether it was right or not. So it's almost prophetic of Moses. It's a warning. He said, you're not supposed to do that. But by the time we get to the book of Judges, we realize that's exactly what Israel has been doing for some time with disastrous consequence. Now, there's two episodes in this concluding section of Judges. First of all, you have Micah and the Levite and the Danites. That's what we're going to look at tonight in chapter 17 and 18. And then there's another story involving a Levite, the Levite and his concubine and the Benjamites in chapters 19 through 21. So it looks at it from the standpoint of some individuals who were doing this and that, and then how that related to the tribes themselves. You find out there are individuals who are compromising the Lord's will in both episodes, and you find out there are entire tribes who are ignoring what the Lord wanted them to do. And again, it spells out the disastrous consequences of both. All right, let's look at this first story. Micah and his idol and all the fun stuff attached to that. We're told in the opening verses of chapter 17, there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke it in my ears, behold, the silver is with me, I took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now therefore I will restore it to you. So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image. And it was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine. And he made an ephod and household gods and ordained one of his sons who became his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's got to be one of the biggest understatements ever in the second part of verse 6. When you think about what Micah and his mother did on this occasion, You got to be shocked at how bad things were. To start with, here's a young man who steals from his mother. You don't steal from your mother. You just don't do that. And then he goes and admits it. He goes and confesses it. We might say, well, that's good. But he confesses it after his mother issues a curse. She curses whoever stole it. She curses her son. She curses whoever stole it. In other words, she's asking God to curse the one who stole it. And she does it in his hearing. Apparently, he heard about it, but when he heard about it, he wasn't willing to admit it. This is some later time, so he goes about with this little secret for a while. He finally confesses it, and what does she do with the curse? Well, had she kept her word, he should have been punished. But no, oh, well, blessed be my son. Oh, you stole it. Well, that's okay. It's no big deal. She just kind of overlooks the fact that he stole from her. She doesn't keep her vow. Have we heard that in the book of Judges already? Someone not keeping their vow. We've read about that with Jephthah. So she's not keeping her word. And again, she had invoked God. She had invoked God. So it's in the form of a vow. And then she decides, well, here's what I think would be a good idea. Let's just take some of that money and we're going to dedicate it to God. So far, so good. Except, oh, by the way, we're going to make an idol. In fact, we're going to make a couple of idols, a carved image and a metal image. And then you find out that Micah didn't just have an idol or two laying around. He had an entire shrine. He made an ephod. You remember Gideon did that and the problems that that caused. And then we also find out that he ordains one of his sons. Now, remember what we're told back in verse 1? What tribe were they from? They were from Ephraim. Where could priests come from? Not the tribe of Ephraim. So he breaks that little law. So by the time we get to verse 6, they violated commandment number 1, you shall have no other gods. They've violated commandment number 2, you shall have no idols before you. They have violated commandment number 3, they have taken God's name in vow in vain by breaking a promise to him. They have violated commandment number 5, Micah had, by failing to honor his father and mother. He had violated commandment number 8, which said you're not supposed to steal. Possibly number 9, you're not supposed to bear false witness. By kind of covering this up in front of his mother and lying to her, that may have fallen under that category. And then violated commandment number 10, you shall not covet. And then that's among the Ten Commandments. That doesn't even address the other facets of the law. They clearly violated Deuteronomy 12, which was this extensive prohibition against high places and shrines in the land. And they violated the commandments concerning who could be a priest. They're just all over the place. They may as well take their Bibles and cut out Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy and just burn it. Because they were obviously ignoring wholesale the commands of God. And that's just the beginning of the story. In 6 verses, they've managed to do all of that. And what the writer is doing is portraying to us how bad things were at that particular time. So it starts out with him building a shrine. Well, as if that's not enough, we're told that the scenery changes in verse 7. There was a young man of Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed from the town of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn where he could find a place. And as he journeyed, he came to the hill country of Ephraim to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I am a Levite of Bethlehem in Judah. I'm going to sojourn where I may find a place." Micah said, "Stay with me and be a father and a priest. And I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year and a suit of clothes and your living." And the Levite went in, and the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. And Micah ordained the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. And Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as a priest." And here again, you shake your head and say, what are these people thinking? They're obviously not. Here's a Levite. He lives in Bethlehem in Judah. Now that's a problem. Because if you go back and look at the Levitical cities, Bethlehem was not one of the Levitical cities. So he's not living where he's supposed to be living, which suggests one of two things. Either, you go back to what we read earlier, either the Israelites had not provided him with a city where he was supposed to live, or he just didn't care and went and lived wherever he wanted to. That may be part of the problem, because the next thing is he just wants to go and find a place to live. And by the way, there's another problem with this. If you go to the end of chapter 18, we're told in verse 30, "And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land." That Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses. Now, some translations say son of Manasseh, and some translations say the son of Moses. There's a little bit of a discrepancy in some of the manuscripts. I tend to think he's probably talking about Moses. I don't think it is Manasseh. I think that the true reading is Moses, and if that's the case, we're talking about Moses' grandson. And if that's the case, remember Moses was part, remember The Levites had three branches, the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merarites. The Kohathites had a specific allotment of land, and this priest doesn't live where that was. So again, either he's ignoring the allotment of land, or the lands were never given to them in the first place. So there's violations right and left. He goes out looking for a new place to live. He stumbles across this place where Micah lives in Ephraim, obviously offering him some hospitality, invites him in. They start talking. So what do you do from 9 to 5? I'm a Levite. Well, why don't you be my priest? Now, that solves up one problem, at least in Micah's mind. Well, I don't have to appoint my son. I can get an actual Levite. Wrong. Only the descendants of Aaron could be priests, and only through specifically one of his sons. So he's violating that. His willingness to participate is a problem, and Micah's offer is a problem. And then there's another problem. Even if he were a legitimate descendant of Aaron, what on earth is he doing serving someplace else than the tabernacle? He's willing to serve in a man-made shrine, not authorized by God, and he's willing to serve in a shrine for a family that worshiped idols. You got serious problems right and left. So it reflects badly on Micah and his family and his household, and it reflects badly on this priest. The priest is looking for a deal, and he sure gets one. Not only does he find a better place to live, he finds a lush job. I don't know how much 10 shekels of silver a year and a suit of clothes and room and board. That's a pretty good deal. And he was willing to do that. So that's the offer as it stands. And then the last thing in verse 13, "Now I know the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as a priest." They looked at this in the most selfish possible way. Apparently, they looked at this in a very superstitious sort of way. Well, as long as I have a Levite at my disposal, then I know that God will bless me. Never mind that they're violating the law of God right and left. They're violating it right and left, ignoring it wholesale. So that's the end of chapter 17. Now, another twist in the story comes in chapter 18. Chapter 18, we're introduced to the Danites. Again, chapter 18, verse 1, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and in those days the tribe of the people of Dan was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in, for until then no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them." Why is that? Because you go back to chapter 1, that little paragraph we read at the end of chapter 1, the Amorites drove them out of their country. And what's interesting is we're told that the house of Joseph, now that's not Dan, the house of Joseph, either the Manassites or the Ephraimites or both of them went in and helped Dan. But Dan didn't drive out their own numbers. If you look at the end of Numbers, the Danites had over 60,000 soldiers available to them, as I recall. Either 60 or 40,000. That's a pretty good size number. And if you look on a map at the original allotment of Dan, it's sort of a J-shaped or kind of a backwards J-shape. It's on the coast, and it kind of curves in a little bit. It was not a huge territory. They had plenty of military resources. They just lacked faith. They failed to carry out the commands of God. And so now, what are they doing? They're going and looking for more land. It so happens that they wind up in the hill country of Ephraim. They visit the house of Micah and lodge there. And when they're by the house of Micah, this is verse 3 of chapter 18, they recognize the voice of the young Levite. And they turn aside, so who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What's your business? And he said to them, "This is how Micah dealt with me. He has hired me, and I've become his priest." And they said to him, "Inquire of God, please, that we may know whether the journey on which we are setting out will succeed." And the priest said to them, "Go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord." How utterly presumptuous of both of them. Now, on the surface, we might say, oh, this is great. The Danites are consulting a priest. He wants to know the will of God. Number one, he's not a priest. It was not his place to do that. Secondly, he didn't consult the Lord. All he did was just give his opinion. This was not anything authorized by God. It's in violation of everything that the law of Moses stood for. So you've got that level of perfidy that's added into the story. The five men sent to spy out things and scout the land and so forth, they departed, verse 7, came to Laish. That's way up in the north. They came to Laish and saw the people who lived there, how they lived in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth, and possessing wealth, and how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. They find a wealthy, isolated village that is living in peace, and they say, that's where we're going to live. Now, that kind of plants a seed and takes us a little bit later. We're told in verse 11, 600 men of the tribe of Dan, armed with weapons of war, set out from Zorah and Eshtaol and went up and encamped at Kiriath-Jearim in Judah. We're also told, verse 13, they go back to the hill country of Ephraim, came to the house of Micah. Now, what they decide to do is they go to the household of Micah. This is starts in verse 11. They go to the household of Micah. They know, according to verse 14, that in these houses there are an ephod, household gods, a carved image, and a metal image. Now, therefore, consider what you will do. They turn aside there. They came to the house of the young Levite at the home of Micah and asked him about his welfare. 600 men want to ask this priest, so how you doing? Would you like a promotion? And basically, they loot the shrine. They steal everything and basically take the Levite with him. And he seems to be perfectly willing to go along with them. He doesn't object too strangely. Later in the account, Micah really, really objects, although they threaten to kill him. We're told in verse 21, they turned and departed, putting the little ones and the livestock and the goods in front of them. When they had gone a distance from the home of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house were called out, and they overtook the people of Dan. And they shouted to the people of Dan, who turned and said to Micah, "What's the matter with you that you come with such a company?" And he said, "You took my gods that I made the priest. Isn't that rich? You took my gods that I made." That's exactly right. They were idols. Idols made with hands. "You took my gods that I made and the priest and go away, and what have I left? How then do you ask me, what's the matter with you?" And the people of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry fellows fall upon you and you lose your wife with the lives of your life with the lives of your household." These are Danites. They are part of the Israelites. They're stealing from a brother. They're stealing from the Ephraimites, a brother tribe. And not only that, they're threatening him with violence. Again, it shows the decline of the nation. It shows how bad things had gotten among the Israelites. Then the people of Dan went their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. I guess he had nothing more to say. The Danites outnumbered them, and he was unwilling to fight them. Verse 27, this is the last thing. They take the city of Laish. Verse 27, "But the people of Dan took what Micah had made and the priest who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone." Now, it repeats verbatim what was said about them. It's a small, wealthy town. They're rather isolated. They have a peaceful existence. They are far from Sidon. Apparently, that emphasizes that they were a Sidonian possession. They were owned by the Phoenicians. But they were so far removed from the Sidonians, from any nearby villages or towns, that they knew they were unprotected. And so they go in, and we're told that they slaughtered them. They had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rahab, and they rebuilt the city and lived in it. They named the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born to Israel, but the name of the city was Laish at first. And the people of Dan set up the carved image for themselves, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. By the way, this has future ramifications as well. Keep your finger there and turn all the way up to 1 Kings. Remember, after Solomon died, the kingdom was split between Rehoboam in the south, who was Solomon's son, and Jeroboam in the north. And to maintain loyalty in the north, Jeroboam decided to reshape the religion of the land. He wanted to make sure that his people didn't, religion was nice and convenient for his people. And we're told in 1 Kings chapter 12, in verse 29, he set one in Bethel. He had two calves of gold, verse 28. He said, "You have gone to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." He set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. He also made temples on high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. Does that sound familiar? It should. This has been, by the time we get to the time of Jeroboam, this has been a long-standing practice. And apparently the city of Dan, I guess forever, had this proclivity toward idolatry. They were more than willing to accommodate. They were more than willing to compromise the worship of God. They were more than willing just to do their own thing. And a lot of it started right here with this story in Judges chapter 17 and 18. Isn't that a depressing story? There is complete disregard for the law of God. As I said in the first six verses, about six or seven of the Ten Commandments are broken blatantly. And everybody's okay with that. And that's one thing I want to emphasize. If you go back to that statement at chapter 17 in verse 13, Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as a priest." We need to understand they thought this was okay. They were perfectly fine doing this. In fact, they never even questioned their relationship to God. They believed that the Lord's okay with this. After all, we're Israelites. After all, we have Levites and priests and that kind of thing. They were so self-deceived that it never even crossed their minds that this is not how God's people behave. So it's an awful situation. And the best commentary is the one that is provided by verse 6 of chapter 17. "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." What happens when you resort to doing your own thing? What happens when you abandon God's authority? What happens when you abandon God's standard of morality and righteousness? What happens when you're willing to do whatever it is that you want to do? Well, this is what results. There's three kinds of chaos that result. Number one, homes suffer. Again, those first six verses are just awful. A young man steals from his mother. And by the way, did you note the amount? 1,100 pieces of silver. One chapter earlier, when the Philistine lords made the deal with Delilah, they offered her 1,100 pieces of silver. This is almost $50,000 worth of silver, if you want to put it in today's terms. And you can imagine the buying power that that had back in those days. But the difference is, I would expect that from Delilah. She was a Philistine. She was looking out for her own country. She was looking out for herself. This is an Israelite stealing from his own mother. And then she says, well, that's okay. Bless my son. That's okay, son. So what if you're a liar and a thief? You're still my son. She just kind of overlooks the thing. And the fact that they were willing to have false religion in their home says a lot about the dynamics of the home. When we abandon God's authority, homes suffer. And if you look at our culture today, is it any wonder that homes have the troubles that they do? When you decide that God's laws regarding marriage, regarding the permanence of marriage, just don't apply, when you just decide that you don't really like that, fine for anyone else, but that's just not my game. Is it any wonder that the divorce rate is what it is? When you decide that raising a child without benefit of both parents is a good thing, and sometimes it may be beyond your control, but often people make that conscious decision. That's one of the things that really bugs me anymore with celebrities. It's just like they go out and have a baby. We're not planning on getting married. I can do this by myself. I can be a single mom. I can be a single dad. That's just normal in our culture. Why? Because people are doing what is right in their own eyes. All of the flap these days about homosexuality and all of the sexual perversions that are out there, It has nothing to do with God. It has to do with, this is what I want, and I will do it regardless of the consequences. I'll do it regardless of what you think, and in fact, to the best of my ability, I'll make sure you like it. They're in your face. They want to make sure that everybody accommodates them. And the whole thing goes back to this. They do what is right in their own eyes, and as a consequence, the home suffers. Also, religion suffers. This whole business of the idolatry and the shrines and the carved images and the metal images and setting up a shrine in their own home and doing their own thing and selling the priesthood to whoever would take it, whether they were qualified or not, it was an abomination. And the Danites are no better. They just come in and steal religion. I guess for them, religion is portable. I like your shrine. I like your idols. I like your priest. Here, you come go with me. And the Levite was perfectly willing to do that. And again, the best textual evidence is that apparently this is Moses' grandson. How awful that they were willing to do that. But you see the same thing today. So much of religion in our culture has nothing to do with the Bible. It has nothing to do with right and wrong. It has nothing to do with authority. It has to do with, well, we like this. Several years ago, about 3, maybe 4 years ago, I had a cousin that lived in the St. Louis area. She's a little bit older than me, died unexpectedly. I went up to her funeral. This is when we were living in Louisville. And I went up to her funeral. It's just a short drive, not too far of a drive from Louisville to St. Louis. The funeral was kind of on the northwest part of St. Louis. I don't really remember the area that well, but it was at this humongous Christian church of some sort. I don't really remember much about it. What I remember was their main facility, the sanctuary and all the other stuff, was under construction. So we met in kind of a small chapel. Small chapel probably seated 400 people, but anyway. The way they had the entrance to the building, you kind of had to go in the back door. And the first thing you saw when you walked in was the game room. I kid you not. The youth center game, it was a pinball place. That's all it was, and electronic games. And you have to ask yourself, did Jesus die so that we can play better games? Is that it? Absolutely not. And then if you went to the left instead of to the right, there was the dining area. And you shake your head and say, is this what the religion of Christ has reduced itself to? And in the minds of many, that's exactly what it is. Mega churches today go out first and do extensive marketing surveys. They don't say, you know, let's go preach the gospel over here and let's see who obeys the gospel, and then that's how we'll start a church. No, 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 no. You start out with marketing surveys. You survey what are the hot places in town. What are the best places to plant? What are the demographics of this area? What kind? We want to appeal to a certain kind of person, and they research income. They research marriages and families and ages and races and that kind of thing. They want to know the demographics of the neighborhood before they plant a church, because they want a high probability of numerical and financial success. It's marketing. It's not about the power of God to save people's souls. It's marketing is what it is. And it's the result of this mentality that we're going to do what we want to do. And it's a very old problem, as we see here in Judges chapter 17 and 18. And then, of course, society suffers. This is seen in the bullying mentality of the Danites. They weren't brave enough to defend their own land. I think it's interesting that the book of Judges starts with trouble with the Danites, and it ends with trouble with the Danites. Chapter 1, they were not brave enough. They were not faithful enough to go and do the job that God had assigned to them. They simply refused to do it. In fact, one of their brother tribes came and helped them. Well, later, when we get to the end of the book of Judges, they've forgotten all that. Now they're brave enough to go out. Number one, they've never secured their land, so they said, well, we got to find a place to live. Rather than taking the land that God commanded them to take, they go off and look someplace else. We're going to go take our land. And instead of remembering the loyalty of the Ephraimites earlier, remember the sons of Joseph had helped them back in chapter 1? Well, who is it that they pick on now? The Ephraimites, the sons of Joseph. They're not even loyal to people who had helped them. And not only that, but they go to a town that is undefended and they slaughter them. That's what happens to society. When people do exactly what they want to do, are we surprised at the violence that we see every day in the news? Are we surprised at the rudeness and the selfishness that people exhibit when they treat one another in such horrible ways on a day-to-day basis? It shouldn't surprise us. It's the outcome of doing your own thing. All of which is to say, don't do your own thing. That is not an accident. That four times it mentions in Judges chapter 17 through 21, there was no king in those days. And twice, at the beginning of that epilogue and at the end of the epilogue, it says, everyone did what was right in their own sight. And what chapter 17 and 18 exhibit is the profound problems of turning our backs on God and thinking that we know a little bit better than He does. We don't. We're fools if we think that. You don't have the right to decide what is right. God has not given you that authority. You don't have the capacity. You don't have pure enough motives. You don't have what it takes to decide for yourself what is right and what is wrong. You don't have it. Only God has that right because He is holy, He is righteous, He is just, He made us, He knows what is best for us, and He expects us to live accordingly. We need to avoid that temptation to do our own selfish thing. I remember when Hannah was little, you know, we used to go out and buy all these kids' books for, when our kids were little. And there was one, we never bought it, but I loved the title of it. It was called How to Be Your Own Selfish Pig. I love the title of that. That's what you fight with your kids. You want to train them, please, don't be a selfish pig. You want to grow up and you want to do what's right. You want to listen to the voice of authority. And if you're not willing to listen to the voice of authority, you're going to wind up in the kind of moral mess that we see in Judges chapter 17 and 18. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, we want to offer you the opportunity to obey Jesus as Lord. And what that means is quit doing your own thing. You submit entirely to the Lord Jesus. Sometimes we as Christians do a lousy job of doing that. Sometimes we get selfish. Sometimes our selfish ambition gets the best of us and we revert to the old selfish ways. And we always do it with disastrous consequences. If you're here tonight and subject to the Lord's invitation in any way, we'd invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.